ॐ भद्रं कर्णैश्वयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः सुष्ठुवागंसस्तनूभिः व्यसेमदेवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्ताक्षो अरिष्टनेमि स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरिः ॐ तत्सत् श्रीरामकृष्णार्पणमस्तु। Now we already discussed some of the important aspects of Turiya, the fourth state, the higher transcendental state. Now, in the commentary, that is commentary here means Karika, Gaudapada's Karika on the Mandukya Upanishad, this is a very famous verse, which brings about the philosophical, even the ethical, spiritual dimension of this idea. So, as I mentioned yesterday, this is not a concept, it's not a doctrine, it is a state of spiritual evolution, spiritual experience. So, very often, our mind could play a trick when we read a book and when we are highly impressed by a great doctrine which appeals to our intellect. So we are highly inspired. And then there is a problem, suddenly we may delude ourselves into thinking that we have reached the experience dimension of that concept. That's actually a great problem with spiritual ideas. So that's something very important. A great idea, a great concept serves the purpose of a goal for us to reach. I can give just one example, which I mentioned yesterday during our discussion in the evening. I mentioned that Swamiji tried to place before us a great universal paradigm, universal religion, that places the ideal beyond and above the individual. A great spiritual idea that's meant for the whole humanity, not just for one religious tradition or one culture. It's meant for the whole humanity. Anybody in the world, belonging to any religion or belonging to no religion, even a self-proclaimed atheist or agnostic, can look upon this ideal, and it will be very helpful to him to become more broad-minded. To have a broad view. Now, a broad view doesn't necessarily mean that we accept or blindly take everything from everybody. It only prevents us from being fanatical, being rigid, and of course being hypocritical. That's the purpose of a great ideal. So even if you have not reached this ideal, if we place this ideal on our mental horizon, that will prevent us from becoming too rigid, too fanatical. And that's why Swamiji wanted to place this ideal before the whole humanity, because it will help us from becoming a small cult. Though it has not become an experience in our spiritual life, still the possibility of a higher spiritual ideal at the distant horizon that we have some time in the mind will help us from becoming fanatical. Sri Ramakrishna again in the Gospel puts in a very simple language. He says, put jnanam means the highest spiritual ideal. Of course, Sri Ramakrishna, they used to wear dhotis, you know. So dhoti, you keep somewhere tied the dhoti. Let us say in modern times, put in your coat pocket or the pocket of the shirt, and you move about in the world. Now, why don't you hold it in your hand? May I ask the question? Because Holding it in our hands means it has become our daily experience, something that guides us every thought and action. It has not reached that stage. So you read a great ideal, even as an intellectual concept, it has got a great creative, constructive purpose to serve. The possibility of a higher universal spiritual paradigm will help us from becoming, will prevent us from becoming rigid and fanatical. So that's it. There you find, even as a concept, it has a great value. But remember, a concept should become an experience. We are going, we will deal with a particular verse in the Kariga, we deals with that experience dimension of this concept. Now, as a concept is mentioned here, the verse is, it comes in the Advaita Prakaranam, you know, the Mandukya Kariga, is a commentary written by a great philosopher who lived almost 200 years before Shankaracharya, and his name was Gaudapada. And his great unique contribution is that he deals with all existing philosophical systems of his times, and especially he focuses on the four important schools of Buddhism: Sautrantika, Vaibhashika, the two schools of realism, and Vijnanavada and Shunyavada. So from that perspective, is a very, very important philosophical document in the history of world thought. It is considered to be so. So the verse is this: So siddhanta vyavasthasu dvaitino nischita dridham parasparam virudhyante taihi ayam na virudhyate. A simple verse, four lines. It's a great document. What it says is, So siddhanta vyavasthasu. Now, he draws a line of demarcation. On the one hand, we have those schools of thought who don't believe in a universal spiritual ideal like Atman, but who are focused on their own individual respective philosophical doctrine and considers to be the only one and nothing else. That's one school of thought. Rather, one group of philosophers. They're called Dvaitins or Dualists. So Shankaracharya in his commentary gives the examples of other Indian schools of thought, which were very rigid at that time. They were called dualists. So as I mentioned earlier, there is an evolution and progress from duality to non-duality. It is a progress from the idea that my ideal, my religion is only true religion, everything else is false, from that ideal to a higher concept. Well, my religion is okay, is the best for me. That may not be the best for another person. The other person who approaches the Supreme Truth from a different perspective can have his own or her own view. For him, that's the best. For me, this is the best. So, that means I should admit that my path is okay for me, but that need not be okay for other persons. Just because it is all right for me. That means there is a possible diversity of paths and unity of goal. So the possibility that the goal may be one, the paths may differ. There could be different trails, different tracks leading to the same summit of the hill. But you understand that these are all different tracks, trails leading to the same top of the hill, only when you reach the top of the hill. See, suppose think of a hill, you are trying to reach the top of the hill, and we follow one tree, and we don't see anybody anywhere nearby, because there's only trail we can see, because we are still walking. But when we reach the top of the hill, and when we look downward, then you find that there are so many tracks, roads leading from the bottom of the hill, reaching the top. And there are so many people, different cultures, different traditions. There is Jesus walking, Buddha walking, Zarathustra walking, and all these great spiritual teachers are walking, and they're taking their own followers, following different tracks and roads, leading the same goal. but we don't understand this possibility of multiple tracks till we reach the top of the hill. So, similarly, Advaita or non-dualism tells us that a goal is not a philosophical conviction, but a spiritual experience. Still, spiritual experience has not become real in our life. But even the conviction of the possibility of such a spiritual experience has a tremendous creative purpose to serve. It saves us from philosophical fanaticism or exclusivism in the language of interfaith conversations. So, here the commentator says, those who are fully convinced of their own path as the only path leading to the same goal, as only one goal and one path. That's their conviction. That's their belief. Those who are dualists. Dualist here means, as you remember, dualism means I and my God are two entirely different entities. God created this world and created all these things for me to eat and enjoy. And I can have a complete license if I am in good terms with God. So God is on my side, then we can be anything. That means we can worship God in the place of worship on the one hand and get the rest of humanity on the other. This can go together. This is the essential characteristic of philosophical schools. In India, there were terribly fanatical schools of thought. In fact, I won't mention normally, you know, because their followers are still there even in this country. You know. It's called Nitya Naraka Siddhanta. It's called the concept of eternal damnation, which you don't find any other Abrahamic tradition. I won't mention all of them. The concept of eternal damnation, Nitya Naraka Siddhanta. Nitya means eternal, Naraka means hell, Siddhanta means doctrine. There are some people who are permanent residents of hell. The permanent essential address is hell. That's a belief. It's in India. It's dualism or Siddhanta. So, of course, nowadays even those who belong tradition that cult have become Advaitins, it's a different matter. So, this was the altar time in many traditions. Now, Gaudapada says that they're fighting among themselves. Because they think only their road will take to the top of the hill. Other roads won't take. So they fight. Duritino Nishida Dhridhaful. Parasparam Virudhyanthe means that mutually quarrel among themselves. But this Advaita, non-dualism, which believes in the Turiya, the transcendental state, as the ultimate spiritual experience, have no quarrel at all with them. Because we know, though they call it by a different name, they are actually meditating on the same reality, same God whom we meditate upon. So it is only a matter of opinion, so we have no quarrel with it. Now this is the view of dualists. Now Shankaracharya has written a marvelous commentary on this. That's what I'm going to read. I know that it's a Sanskrit text, but it has got the magic of the words spoken and written by a great spiritual teacher almost 200 years back. So when we read the original words, whether it is the Bible or the Talmud or the Torah, Buddhist Tripitakas, you know, when we read these original texts, it has got the magic, because these texts, these words have survived 1200 years, 1300 years, and were read upon, were read by great thinkers, meditated upon, contemplated upon, and so these words acquire a tremendous spiritual potency of sanctity. You know, a word or a letter has got a peculiar way of accumulating potency. When you meditate upon a word, when you think upon it, when great spiritual seekers with pure devotion meditate upon and even read and contemplate upon a sacred word, that words acquires a tremendous spiritual potency. Then that word is called a mantra. So mantra, the definition of mantra itself means manana prayate iti mantra. Means when you meditate upon, when you contemplate intensely upon the sanctity of a sacred word symbol, that word symbol is no more just a formation of alphabet letters. It becomes an entity in itself. Maybe the classical example in Christian tradition is the famous Jesus prayer, which you find elaborately discussed in the classical works like The Way of a Pilgrim and so on. When he learned that prayer, Jesus' prayer, which St. Paul had referred to in the first epistle, when the pilgrim learned it from a Russian Orthodox monk in his own private cell in a monastery, when he realized it, immediately his heart lighted up. You remember? His heart became filled with compassion, with joy, a tremendous inexpressible joy, delight, tranquility. You read in the Way of a Pilgrim. Maybe that's one classical illustration from a Christian tradition of the potency of a sacred word symbol. So here I'm reading the original text, the commentary. Susiddhanta vyavasthasu, susiddhanta rajana vishay niyameshu, kabila kanada buddha arkhadadi drishtyanisarino dvaitino nischitaha. Evameva esha paramartho nanyatha iti tatra tatra anurektaha pratipaksham cha atmanaha pasyantaha tam dushantaha ityevam ragadvishopetaha. Susiddhanta darsana nimittam eva parasparam anyonya viruthyante. The statement is this. The dualist is not a blame on a dualist. Dualism in a way has got its own meaning. You know, you start your education in the primary school or the kindergarten, so nothing wrong in it, but you consider the kindergarten as the last point of your education, there's a problem. So, here the commentator says, these dualists, you know, they are followers of Kapila. Kapila means Sankhya philosophy. Kanada, you know, is a Vaisheshika philosophy, Nyaya philosophy, Gautama, and Buddha. Buddhism, you should remember, there is a reference to Buddhism in the Gaudapada text, not always in a very complimentary term. For that, you should understand, because very often it could lead to many misunderstandings. In this Karika text, you find references to Buddhist philosophy, and not always in a very complimentary term. There is a reason for it. Buddhism had already evolved for almost 1200 years when these words were written. Buddhism at last its emphasis on nirvana or spiritual illumination. It had become a kind of nihilistic, anarchist, self-destructive, dialectical system in India. But it had not reached that kind of dialectical no man's land in China, Japan, Korea and other countries. Because Buddhism, when it traveled outside India, it got adapted to many of the local cultural traditions of the Far Eastern countries. But in India, what happened, you know, because of the intensity of philosophical speculation and the dialectical warfare, a large number of polemical works were written on Buddhism. So as a result, Buddhism lost its spiritual focus. Even Buddha would not have recognized the Buddhist system of philosophy that Shankaracharya had to confront during his time, 1200 years after Buddha's passing away. So, it was Shankaracharya's task to, in a way, to point out the errors of Buddhist doctrine as it existed at that time. So, I can give many examples. For example, they believed, I mentioned yesterday, the two schools of idealism, that nothingness or voidness or emptiness, as it is literally means in a dictionary, that nothingness or emptiness is the ultimate category according to Nagarjuna's school of philosophy. But Nagarjuna's original book defines nothingness in a different language. He says it is one inexpressible, indescribable, ultimate spiritual experience which is beyond description. It is beyond description, so Nagarjuna gave it the name empty in the sense it cannot be really understood in words or through sensory perception. It is a non-dual ultimate experience. That's what Nagarjuna said. But this was taken out of the context and it became highly misunderstood. You know what? This could happen when a philosophical doctrine is closely followed by a group or a cult. What do you call sampradaya? So when a philosophical doctrine or a spiritual doctrine is taken up by a large number of followers, very often all the followers may not be able to fully understand its philosophical implication. So very often it could lose its original focus. Let us say the Christianity as interpreted by the by Cortes or Pizarro or Columbus or Vasco da Gama or the conquistadors or the inquisitors may be totally different from the Christianity of Jesus. So you can see the difference. It happens in all traditions. The humanistic spiritual teachings of Jesus are in total contrast to the way Christianity was spread by Cortes and Pizarro in Latin American countries. So totally different. So that kind of departure from the mainstream teachings could happen in all traditions. So that happened in Buddhism also. That's why here Shankaracharya says, the followers of Kapila, I mean Sankhya philosophy, Kanada, that is a kind of Indian atomism. It is an Indian school of atomism. And Buddha, mostly the commentator is referring to the school of Shunyavada or doctrine of emptiness. Today's interpretation, today you can read wonderful books written by translated into English from Tibetan and Chinese languages by many great Lama. They present a much more, much more spiritual, much closer to the original teachings of Buddha. But in 8th century, things were different. So that should be kept in mind when we read these books. Arkada and others, they are fully established in their basic principles and they believe that their doctrine alone is the real doctrine, nothing else. They believe that this alone, evameva, esha paramartha, paramartha, nanyatha, truth can be reached and practiced only in this particular manner. There is no other way. That is their path. This is wrong. That's the commentator says. So their attachment to their own conclusion, that's the meaning of Sosiddhanta, one's own philosophical doctrinal conclusion. They identify it among themselves because they read their scriptures and then they interpret literally and then they lose the spiritual focus and then they think their view is the only view to ultimate reality and all other views are wrong. So what happened, you know, because of their attachment, fanatical attachment to their own doctrine, which they interpret in a very narrow language, they become fanatical and they quarrel with all other systems of philosophy, with all other traditions. Now, then the commentator says, in the next paragraph, we see, Taihi anyonilodibhihi asmadiyoyam vaitikaha ಸರ್ವಾನನ್ಯತ್ವ ಆತ್ಮೈಕತ್ವ ದರ್ಶನ ಪಕ್ಷೋ ನ ವಿರುದ್ಧ್ಯದೆ ಯಥಾ ಸೂರ್ಯಸ್ತಪಾದಾದಿಭಿ. ಓಕೆ, ನೌ ಸೊ ದೇ ಫೈಟ್ ಅಮಂಗ್ ದೆಮ್ಸೆಲ್ವ್ಸ್ ಬಿಕಾಸ್ ದೇ ಆರ್ ಮ್ಯೂಚುಲಿ ಎಕ್ಸ್ಕ್ಲೂಸಿವ್. ಬಟ್ ದಿಸ್ ಅದ್ವೈತ ಹ್ಯಾಸ್ ನೋ ಕ್ವಾರಲ್ ವಿತ್ ದಮ್, ಬಿಕಾಸ್ ಈವನ್ ಇನ್ ದೇರ್ ಡಾಕ್ಟ್ರಿನ್ಸ್ ದ ಅದ್ವೈತಿನ್ ಸೀ ದ ಟ್ರೂತ್ ಬಟ್ ಇಂಟರ್ಪ್ರಿಟೆಡ್ ಅಂಡ್ ಅಪ್ರೋಚ್ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಎ ರಾಂಗ್ ಪರ್ಸ್ಪೆಕ್ಟಿವ್. ದ ಸೇಮ್ ಟ್ರೂತ್ ಬಟ್ ಇಂಟರ್ಪ್ರಿಟೆಡ್ ಇನ್ ನ್ಯಾರೋ ಲ್ಯಾಂಗ್ವೇಜ್ ಆರ್ ಅಪ್ರೋಚ್ಡ್ ಫ್ರಮ್ ಎ ನ್ಯಾರೋ ಆಂಗಲ್ ವಿಲ್ ಕ್ರಿಯೇಟ್ ಮಿಸ್ಅಂಡರ್ಸ್ಟ್ಯಾಂಡಿಂಗ್ಸ್. So therefore, though their path is different, we have no quarrel with them, because even among them who quarrel among themselves, Advaitins see the presence of the same Atman. So you see in your own enemy, even among those who are in total disagreement with you, your own Atman. It doesn't mean, as Sri Ramakrishna said, no, there is a tiger. Tiger is Atman, we are Atman, no. But then, we should keep the distance in discrimination, that means proper discerning wisdom. At the same time, it will make us hate internally. So, we have no quarrel with them. The example is given, yatha sovasta padadibhihi. We don't quarrel, we cannot quarrel with our own hand, our own body. See, if you hit your left hand, then the right hand. If you hit your own head with your right hand, you will feel the pain, nobody else. So we cannot quarrel with others without actually hurting ourselves. We cannot do harm to others without harming ourselves. So this kind of unity, oneness, on the basis of the presence of the same Atman, the same soul in everyone, this is the special feature of this experience. ಏವಂ ರಾಗ ದ್ವೇಷಾದಿ ದೋಷ ಅನಾಸ್ಪದತ್ವಾತ್ ಆತ್ಮೈಕತ್ವ ಬುದ್ಧಿ ಮೀನ್ಸ್ ವೆನ್ ಯು ಸೀ ದ ಪ್ರೆಸೆನ್ಸ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ಸೇಮ್ ಆತ್ಮನ್ ಇನ್ ಎವ್ರಿ ಒನ್ ದೆನ್ ಯು ಕಾನ್ ಹೇಟ್ ಎನಿ ಒನ್ ದೇರ್ ಇಸ್ ನೋ ಬೇಸಿಸ್ ಫಾರ್ ಎನಿ ಕೈಂಡ್ ಆಫ್ ಅವರ್ಷನ್ ಇಸ್ ಲಿಟರಲ್ ಮೀನಿಂಗ್ ಆಫ್ ಇಟ್ ಸೊ ಯು ಕಾನ್ ಹೇಟ್ ಎನಿ ಒನ್ ದೇರ್ಫೋರ್ ದಿ ಅದ್ವೈತ ದ ನಾನ್ ಡಿವಿನಿಸ್ಟ್ ಫಿಲಾಸಫಿ has no quarrel with anyone. That's the idea behind. So there is a commentary in the shorter commentary. Yatha surasta padadi bhihi kadajit aghade krute vidvesho na jayate parabuddhi abhavat. So sarva ananyatva ityartha. The commentator says, if you hit your own body with your own hand, you feel the pain, but you don't feel any hatred to your own hand with which you hit your own head. That's it. So, I mean, it's a concept of looking upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. So, you can imagine how long we traveled. We started with the analysis of waking state, dream state and deep sleep experiences. We have to begin again to understand the relevance, the importance. So first, we started analyzing the experiencer, the perceiver, the subject in waking state. And also, the experiencer, the perceiver, the subject in dream state. Both are the same. The same perceiver, seer, is present in dreamless or deep sleep state. This is the unity of at the level of subject. The same witness, the same experiencer, the same perceiver. In all the three states. Then the Upanishad tells you, well, there is one reality that is present in all the three states, which means that reality transcends all the three states. If the same reality is present as a witness, as an experiencer, as a subject, in all the three states, then that reality should be a transcendental reality. That is not confined or limited to any of the three states. That is Atman. Now, what happens when we understand it as a doctrine? If we understand this as a doctrine, it can help us in, first of all, it will help us to interpret our own life experiences as they should be interpreted. Should I mention this? One main problem is that we often superimpose permanence on impermanent things. Intellectually, we know the experiences of this empirical life come and go. They are momentary, they are not eternal. But when there is a problem with this difficulty, somehow we forget the momentariness or the transitoriness of this. And we somehow delude ourselves into thinking that is a permanent problem. And this interpretation, wrong interpretation, makes us too much concerned and worried. So what happens, you know, for a moment, a small problem becomes an absolute, intimidating dilemma.
Insurmountable.
Yeah, insurmountable. It is a small problem becomes a huge dilemma. For a moment, we focus on that. But when you read this philosophy, then you are able to look back and relax and look at it from a different perspective. Not that we go and sleep over the problem, or we neglect taking steps to solve the problem. But the point is, we are able to put them in the proper place where it belongs to. So it helps us to reorganize the whole priority system. So what happens, you know, when we look upon ourselves as this reality, this Turiya, this Atman, that transcends the psychophysical mechanism or body-mind complex, then we are able to look upon these problems from a different perspective. That's one thing. And then, on the other hand, from a purely psychological point of view, this is one advantage. And in a way, it is not doctrine. Anybody who has studied in the primary school will understand that money, wealth, all these things come and go. Everyone knows when you read newspapers, the stock markets, the share markets collapse. It's substantial. Things do happen. We know that. But for a moment, we forget this essential characteristic of this transitoriness. And we expect perfection from what is essentially imperfect. We expect permanence from something that is essentially impermanent. So this misinterpretation creates all the problems, anxieties. This is one point of view. Second point of view, from a purely doctrinal point of view, the idea that this state in a way represents a high philosophical doctrine of universalism, spiritual universalism, whether it may be cultural diversity, maybe diversity in terms of customs, conventions, language, religious faith, whatever it is. Diversities are not necessarily a cause for problem, rather that diversity should be interpreted as so many different parts, the possibility of diverse parts leading to the same goal. So that is the practical advantage. So I shall go through some of the more important verses, again from the Gaudapada's famous classic. Now, I'm here because I felt I should read this text because it's in a way the original source of what we discussed day before yesterday after reading Swamiji's Jnana Yoga lectures. You remember Swamiji says, liberation of moksha. Even if you are not aware of the fact that you are Atman, you are Atman. The fact that you are Atman is not because you believe you are Atman. Even if you believe you are anything else, you don't cease to be Atman. So there is an important aspect about this concept of liberation. Of course, here, from a doctrinal point of view, a few important differences should be pointed out at the very beginning. In non-Vedantic systems of India, like Vaishnava, Shakta, Saiva traditions, And also in mainstream Abrahamic traditions, except the mystical systems, of course, you know, spiritual enlightenment, liberation is a gift from God. There's a basic premise. That is true in the Indian theistic systems of devotional philosophy. It's a gift from God. Now, this is not rejected. So in Vedanta, you should remember, one path, when you discuss two different paths, we don't say one path is wrong, the other is right. Rather, it is to say that the devotion philosophy is wrong or the path of knowledge is right is like saying what you study in the primary school is totally different from what you study in a university. No. In a university, you study much more than what you study in a primary school. Very often based in the foundation maybe what you already studied in primary school. So, if A is B, it doesn't mean that, if A and B exist, and if you say A is right, it doesn't mean that B should be wrong. That's an important point to be kept in mind at the doctrinal level. In Vedanta, if A is right, then B need not be wrong. B also may be right. Maybe B is a way for us, for you to reach A. Two levels of spiritual experience as you follow the same path. So that should be understood very clearly. Because Vedanta totally rejects the doctrine of evil. That's an important point. Vedanta totally rejects the doctrine of evil. We make mistakes, we commit errors, not because an anthropomorphic evil force tempts us to do something wrong, but because we are ignorant, so we do something wrong. So Vedanta posits the doctrine of error in place of the doctrine of evil. And that's an important point to remember. Which means, if A is right, there is no reason to argue that B is wrong. B and A can be equally right, but only from you start with A and you reach B. Or it could be the other way around. Depends upon that. That means we evolve in spiritual life, and as we evolve in spiritual life, we also evolve higher and higher concepts of the supreme reality of God, based on our own spiritual evolution, our own inner experience. A primitive person may think his God sits in a temple, and if he goes there, worships there, puts a little money in the box, his God is fine, okay. And so his religious life is just 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in the evening. It could be for any tradition. Nothing wrong in it. Just as there is nothing wrong if you go to kindergarten at the beginning of your education career. But as we evolve further, we start feeling the presence of the same God, even outside the temple, outside the church, and at the highest level of spiritual experience, we look upon the whole creation as an expression of the divine, the whole humanity as one spiritual family, not only humanity, whole creation as one spiritual family. This is how we evolve in spiritual life, and this is how our concept of God also evolves as we evolve in spiritual life. So that should be kept in mind. At the highest stage, Vedanta tells you, liberation is your natural state. Being in a liberated state, this transcendental state of experience is not something that we acquire, that we create, that we manufacture, or that comes from somebody else as a gift. It is something that you discover. If a person forgets his name for some reason, and then he suddenly remembers his name, he doesn't go about clapping his hands and singing song, he has got something new. He has just he just rediscovered something that was already his. There's nothing new coming. So, that should be kept in mind. Before reading this verse, I shall explain this in the traditional philosophical language. Vedanta says that spiritual liberation, spiritual enlightenment is not something that you manufacture the way a pot maker manufactures a pot from clay. So it is called na utpadya, means it cannot be manufactured. And Vedantic liberation or moksha, enlightenment, is not something that you reach. So gramantragava means you leave one village and reach another village. When you reach San Francisco from here, you leave Littaku behind. Then only you reach San Francisco. So you are reaching a place, leaving one earlier state behind. Vedanta doesn't accept. You are not going from anywhere to anywhere. You are actually rediscovering your own lost identity, and it is not, it's a new asset you are getting. So it is not, it's called apya, means it is not something that you reach. And it is not something that you acquire through processing. Like for example, you extract oil from oil seeds, or through refineries you extract refined oil from crude oil. So it is not something that you produce through refinement process. It is not samskari. And these are Sanskrit terms, but I have only explained in English. And the other one is, it is not vikaryam. It means just you convert milk into yogurt, curds, so to speak. So it is not apyam, it is not vikaryam, it is not samskaryam, it is not utpatti. These are four terms, which means this liberation is not something that you manufacture. As a pot maker manufactures pots from clay, it is not something that you produce, let us say, by extracting oil from oil seeds. It is not something that you reach, like going from one place to another place. And it is not something that you produce by changing the properties through change, like milk becoming yogurt. So it doesn't belong to any of these categories. Then what is, again you remember when Vivekananda's lecture. So I'm giving the theological, philosophical background. Swamiji said, if you clearly say you are liberated, liberated you will be. You remember the statement. Swamiji makes his loud, his strong statement. It's a great truth. But before we make the statement, we should be able to acquire the degree of intensity, then only we can be like that. The moment you say you are a Buddha, you become a Buddha. But when we make a statement, you are a Buddha, it should be 100% intense. That kind of intensity or integrity should be acquired. And it could be acquired only through a long process of spiritual practices. Meditation, contemplation. Through that process, if you reach that level of intensity, then we understand we are not, it is not a charity, it is not through charity that we become liberated. We are getting back to our real home, which is ours. So we are returning to our true nature, we are returning to our home. That's the real meaning of liberation in Vedanta. Its most intense, its most sublime description is found in this verse, which I am going to read right now. So that's why I created all this background. Otherwise, this statement could be pure anarchy, what I am going to say. It could even be interpreted as a blasphemy. So that's why Sri Ramakrishna used to give strong warnings to some of his disciples. Don't read Ashtavakra Samhita, Yoga Vasishta, all these things. Sri Ramakrishna allowed only some of his disciples to read these verses, you know. Otherwise, it could create something that inner, you know, hypocritical pretensions. Oh, I'm liberated, so it's okay, fine. I'm Brahman, you're Brahman, all right, nothing to do, let us go. It could be pure deception. I'm Brahman, you're also, you're all Brahman, wonderful. Very fine idea. Even so, it could be a kind of spiritual licentiousness or anarchy. So, Sri Ramakrishna used to warn some of his disciples, keep quiet, keep a distance from these ideas. But he used to encourage Swamiji to read this. Vivekananda was not very enthusiastic. He was not even, he was a bit reserved about reading these things. Because he was familiar with, you know, many of the Brahma Samaj. Brahma Samaj is one. More than Brahma Samaj, he was trained in some of the realistic systems of thought, of European thought. You know? So, you know, you find him, he was just familiar with J.S. Mill, Gregory Bentha, Locke, and many others, Spencer and others. So, he was very realistic. And European system, the line of demarcation between a concept or an idea on the one hand and his experience dimension was not always emphasized. Not only that, those who reached the experience dimension were considered to be heretics. Therefore, mystics were persecuted. If you remove the intermediary between God and you, you are preaching blasphemy. So, direct communion with the spiritual experience of God was considered to be an act of sacredness in the mainstream ecclesiastical traditions. So Swamiji was familiar with all this. Swamiji was very careful when Sri Ramakrishna talked. But Sri Ramakrishna knew he was a spiritual aspirant of the highest quality. So he was really fit for this highest truth. So Sri Ramakrishna forced him to read this. On the other hand, there were some well-educated people who came to Sri Ramakrishna, like Yam Mahendranath Gupta, who was a chronicler of the gospel. He was a well-educated man, was familiar with Western schools of thought, Sanskrit and so on. But Sri Ramakrishna didn't encourage him to read this, because he knew temperamentally he had not reached that level of spiritual evolution to really understand its true implication. So, now we are coming to subject. Na nirodho na chotpatti na baddho na cha sadhakah na mumukshur na vai muktah ityesha paramarthah. So, this is verse. You know what it means? There is no beginning, no end, no liberated person, and no one's trying to get liberation, no aspirant, and no enlightenment. That's what it says. See what it means? If liberation is your real true nature, then how can you become an aspirant for liberation? It cannot be. It should be absent in you, then only you will be aspiring for it. So spiritual practices themselves have no value in the true sense that it means, because you are already spiritually enlightened. But remember, as you should always remember, this is meant for the highest. It's the highest doctrine is kept here. This should never be taken literally, because it could lead to terrible misunderstanding. What it emphasizes is this: even if you try for 1,000 years and become a Buddha, still that Buddhahood is not something that you acquire by your practices. By your practices, you discover what was essentially your true nature. So you don't get anything new. It's not a new information that you are Brahman. Even if you believe that you are not Brahman, you are not going to be anything other than Brahman. So that's the idea behind. The fact that you are Brahman is not the result of your conviction that you are Brahman. If it is the result of your conviction that you are Brahman, that is not a big deal. It is not worth having, you know. There is a basic principle behind it. Anything that you acquire through effort is impermanent. That's a basic Vedantic principle. So that's why anirodham, anupadam, anuchedam, ashashvatam. Anegam, ananatum, anigamam, anigram. In fact, this is actually, this is no other than Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna himself defines shunya in this life, in these terms. But what happened, you know, Nagarjuna explained all this, but then his idea was suddenly put upside down, sishasana. It became a negative construct, philosophical construct. That's what happened. Anyway, I'm not going to the detail. Many of these terms are found in the Madhyamika Kariga, which is the Bible of Shunyavada. So, if, to give an example, if, when you read books translated by the great Tibetan scholars, Tibetan Lama scholars, who translated many books from Tibetan language, from old Pali into English, and also from Sanskrit. Madhyamika Kariga is a famous book in chaste, wonderful, elegant Sanskrit, written in the 2nd century AD by Nagarjuna, who was born somewhere in the Andhra Pradesh in South India, and later migrated to Nalanda University, was a professor. So that's a great story of Nagarjuna. Even now the place is the Nagarjuna Kunda, a place that he was born. So he himself says, this shunya is anirodham, and it is not created. It doesn't disappear, it cannot disappear, and it is not created. So, and never comes to an end. It is one. Like that. Anyway, so I'm going to take up the subject again. So nanirodha, that means no utpatti, it has no beginning, it has no end. So liberation cannot have a beginning. If liberation can have a beginning, spiritual enlightenment have a beginning, that means it did not exist sometime in the past. And there is a possibility of it not existing sometime in future. So it belongs to the present. So it is impermanent. It is not one. If liberation is impermanent, then how can it really call liberation? You are liberated today, tomorrow you fall into bondage again. So spiritual liberation, moksha, or spiritual emancipation is not something that comes into existence. That for the simple reason, there was no time when it did not exist. And it cannot have an end, because there will be no time when it doesn't exist. So it is beyond time, beyond space, beyond causation. If it is caused by something else, then it existed as a causal form earlier. So it is a new manifestation. In other words, spiritual liberation is a permanent reality. It is our true nature. Brahman is our real residential identity. That's the idea behind it. Our true identity is Brahman. All other are false identities. That's what it means. Nabadha. Nobody is bound. If liberation is our true nature, then there was no time when we were in bondage. Again, you have to remember what Swamiji said. Swamiji mentioned the same thing, you know. So, you are not, it is, we are hypnotizing ourselves into thinking that we are in bondage. So we have to dehypnotize into thinking that we are actually ever liberated. So you find these words used by Vivekananda. Hypnotism and hypnotism and dehypnotism. So we delude ourselves into thinking that we are bound, we are really not bound. And therefore, because we are never in bondage, we are not a spiritual seeker. What are we? If you seek for something, this is not really, you don't have. If you have billions of dollars, you can't say you are an aspirant for money making. No. You are already within you. So you don't seek something that is already yours. You seek the fact that you look for something, it means that It is right now not with you. It is somewhere. You have to make yours. So, namumukshu. There is no person, there is nobody who is looking for liberation, who wants liberation, who is trying to get liberation. Why? Because you can try to get liberation only if you think the liberation is not with you right now. But liberation is always your natural state, so you cannot really look for liberation. Ittesha paramartha, this is the highest truth. This is the Mandukya Karya. So we have to remember one thing. Sri Ramakrishna's warning, we should always remember. Sri Ramakrishna didn't mean this, that this should be the ideal for all. Even spiritual teachers of the same stature may approach the same reality from a different angle. For among the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, there were great disciples who were more of a devotional type. Sri Ramakrishna didn't want them to take this perspective. Nothing wrong in it, they knew this, but their approach was different. That's all. So, this is the highest spiritual truth that Swamiji was referring to in the lecture that you read maybe the day before yesterday. So I thought this should, this real philosophical source should be discussed today. So, okay, thank you. Now we have interaction.
Yeah. Is this what you call now
in
the Ashtavakra Gita?
This is Mandukya Karya. Ashtavakra Gita is one, Yoga Vasishta Ramayana is one, Adhyatma Ramayana is one, Mandukya Karya. These are the four important texts that take this particular approach. So Ashtavakra Gita is one, Yoga Vasishta is one, Adhyatma Ramayana and Mandukya Karya is also one. Okay.
So going from the same truth, going out from the same
truth. I mean approaching limiting the discussion of the highest to the conclusions, so to speak. It's like proclaiming, giving the highest conclusion to the top of the building. That's what it means. But in the commentary, the great Shankaracharya commented, again he explained all this, and then he has given you practical methods to reach this stage. I shall explain this from a different perspective. Ashtavakra Gita, Yoga Vasishtha, many of these books, they give you the highest conclusions of Vedanta. It's like shouting the highest truth from the top of a, from the roof of a tall building. What Shankaracharya did, he did the same thing, but he arranged an elevator that would take you to the top ladder. He gave you a ladder. Or you threw a stone to the ground, which you can, and which will help you to reach that. Ashtavakra did not do that. In a way, that is true of Ramana Maharshi also. Ramana Maharshi's approach was not totally different, but that's why Sri Ramakrishna himself compares great teachers to different categories, you know. Ashtavakra, they take boat. So you can take a boat, cross the river, and then you go to your place. But great teachers like Shankaracharya, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, they're huge ships. They go up and down. They keep ferrying passengers from this bank to the other bank. They are just like registered ships. Sri Ramakrishna's ship is still going on. You can. So that's the thing. So these great teachers, they give the conclusions, but they also will give you a GPS so that you can reach the goal. So,
you can harm yourself.
What
is that? I didn't understand.
Excuse me? That
you can harm yourself and then...
Oh, yeah. What it means is, see, those who... That I was discussing the other words, Nisu Siddhanta Vyavasthasu, etc. I was mentioning, you know, this verse which I discussed, Susiddhanta Vyavasthasu, Duyatino Nishidatidhan Parasparam Viruddhindi Taihi Ayamna Viruddhiti. Those who are convinced of their own doctrine and believe that their doctrine alone is the true doctrine and everything else is false, they fight among themselves. But Advaita, non-dualistic philosophy, has no quarrel with anyone because they feel they see the same truth in all traditions. So for them, they cannot do any harm to anybody, because by doing harm to another person, we are doing harm to ourselves. There is no other. There is no otherness in Vedanta, Advaita. I mean, the whole existence is one spiritual reality. The spiritual oneness and unity of existence will help you to see the same reality everywhere. So you cannot do harm to others. You realize that by doing harm to another person or anybody, you are doing harm to yourself. Because the other and you are the same, by side.
In the fourth text mentioned, Ashtavakra Gita, Mandukya Tarika, Yoga Vasishta, the fourth one.
This one, Mandukya.
Adhyatma
Ramayana is more than Adhyatma Ramayana. Ashtavakra Gita is more emphatic on this point. But these belong to, these contain many identical approaches.
There's a great deal here that you could expound upon for hours, but the first, at the outset, you say you have this great idea or ideal.
Yeah.
And so we perceive that it's there, but we don't fully get it. Right?
But
get the idea of it, right?
Yeah.
I could dip my toe in Lake Tahoe, and I get the idea, but if I really want to know, I got to get all the way in. I mean, I see that it's there, I dip my toe in it, I perceive it further, but if I want to really know it, I have to dive all the way in.
Yeah.
Now, we remember from reading Swami Vivekananda, he says, we go from the general to the specific, you know, more and more with greater and greater concentration. So that, and then you introduced the concept of the one line that stood out in this talk was, anything you achieve through effort is impermanent.
Yeah.
This is an idea that could make one a perfect karma yogi.
Yeah.
Because you understand you're making an effort.
Yeah.
Something is going to be attained, but the effect will not be permanent, so therefore you have no reason to get attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's a great proclamation in Shankaracharya's commentary. Mokshasya akaryatva means liberation is not the effect of any cause. Cause means in the form of our efforts or anybody giving you in a plate, nothing like that. Liberation is our true nature. But then, why and how do we work? Work is a way for us to do good to others. And also, if right now, if it does not become an experience, if it's only a concept for us right now, it will become an experience one day later through the practice of Nishkama Karma, means deep performance of duty without any attachment. So when we go on doing things, good deeds, without any attachment, then what happens? That produces an effect. That effect is our mind becomes more and more pure. And when the mind reaches the highest level of purity, then this fact becomes obviously a matter of everyday experience. That's an idea. You find an interesting point that we often may not always remember is our mind influences our actions. Our actions also influence our mind. So, we know that if our mind is scattered, if we are disturbed, whatever we do with the senses of perception, with our hands, thinking, all this will be somewhat disturbed. We won't be able to do any work with a lot of focus when the mind is disturbed. That means mind affects as its impact on the way we do our work. Now, this is another important thing. Whatever we do will also have its effect on the mind. So, if a person goes on doing good deeds, noble deeds, even without his being or her being aware of it, that person's mind will acquire a higher and higher level of refinement and purity and nobility. This is often a fact that we understand. I've seen this when I observe, when I read the lives of some of the great industrial captains of modern Western world. People who may have worked very hard, made lots of money, trillions of dollars, becoming billionaires or trillionaires, after some time, they feel like founding a trust for doing help, maybe to help people in third world countries, maybe to help people suffering from epidemic diseases in sub-Saharan countries. You find such instances. Now, why do they feel this this natural tendency to do noble deeds? Because when you do your work following some ethical principles, then then you reach a stage where you feel there is still something higher beyond, and that's a natural broadening of our outlook and mind and attitudes. So you find they've been working hard with a strong purpose, selfish purpose, making lots of money. But then they become slowly less selfish, becoming unselfish. So you find many of them engaging in philanthropic activities. This is a natural human evolution. You cannot control over that. So, and then gradually you find them becoming more and more focused on higher spiritual values. So any noble deed that we practice will have a refining effect on our mind and attitudes. So it works both ways.
Also, we talked about, I was putting it in the context of the Credo in the Christian Church, which believes in the life everlasting. But what they don't tell you is the reason for that life everlasting is because what was never born could never die.
Yeah.
Because that which always existed always shall exist.
Yes.
That was the incomplete part of that picture that I did not get until we arrive at the concept of, you know, that which always existed always will exist.
Yeah.
There's no beginning and no end.
Yes.
They say there's no end, but they don't say there's no beginning.
Yeah, no, there is only, I tell you, I try to explain. The absolute reality has no beginning and no end. It is always there. There is one thing which has no beginning but an end. That is ignorance. Ignorance really has no beginning because it just happens because really ignorance is a relative entity, it's not a permanent entity. When you get enlightenment, ignorance is gone. So it has an end. But then it has no beginning. Ignorance has no beginning, really speaking. So it is called, it is anadi santa. That means, the example is given, you know. I give the example of the rope is taken for a snake, you remember? Okay. Now, when did the snake enter the room? If you ask the question, the answer is the snake did not enter the room. But then when did this wrong notion that there's a snake, it had an end beginning in our mind as a delusion. When you open the door, the snake idea is gone. So it disappears, but it has a beginning. When did it begin? When you saw the rope and you mistook the rope for the snake. The snake was not a snake. The snake was only snake idea. That means an error or an illusion or an ignorance can have a beginning. But then may have a beginning when you saw the object, or may not have a beginning, but it does have an end all the time. Is it clear? No.
It's a temporary condition.
Yes. No. You see, this question is, when did a snake enter the room? The answer is, it did not enter the room. For the simple reason, there was no snake. But there was a snake in your mind, the idea. So that's there. So the snake as it says no beginning, the snake idea had a beginning. That beginning, that snake idea disappeared when you opened the door. You understand it's a rope, that's the idea. See, the dialectical discussion this comes in. It's not relevant in our context.
But if we were inherently pure, right? So why did this, how and why did this ignorance come into
it? Yeah, that's a big question. Yeah, first of all, ignorance and it's coming all related things. But do you understand that this ignorance really was only a superimposition? It is a wrong notion when you come out of it. See, only when you open the windows, then only you come to the conclusion, actually there was no snake. Yeah. Really, like that, when we read scriptures, when we meditate, lead a pure life, a long time, when you realize the true nature, then you suddenly open your eyes to the fact that really there was no snake, there was no ignorance. But the unreality of ignorance becomes clear to you when you come out of it. Just as when you are in a dream, dream objects are as real to the dreamer as waking state objects are real to the person living waking state. When you come out of it, you suddenly realize. That's why there is a verse which I am going to deal with. Anadi maya supto yadha jiva prabuddhide. Ajam anidram asvapnam advailam vidyade tatha. This is a statement in the Karika. We are all in a state of spiritual stupor, sleep.
Why did it start? You know, like Adam was originally pure. Right?
Yeah.
How did we acquire this?
If you link that to Vedanta, yeah, there will be a mismatch, because it is an essentially dualistic system of philosophy. The same question can be asked in Vaishnava, that is, why did God create this world? See, the problem, why there is a need for this Vedanta? The real need comes here. If you think that God created Adam, God created this world, or Vishnu created this universe, okay, fine, in Hindu tradition, let us say, then God could have created this world much better place. See, there would be no diabetes, no health problems, and no traffic jams, everyone's social security, insurance, Medicare, everything, and no hunger, absolutely nothing. God would have created the world in a much better shape. So, there's a big problem that all the great humanists and atheists are asking, Richard Dawkins and others, even a person like Christopher Hitchens, in a cruder language, of course. You ask the question, if there is a God who creates this world, then why should there be all these problems? You can never really reconcile the possibility of a compassionate creator God and this world of miseries and problems and insecurities. But no, remember, Vedanta never says that such a concept is wrong. That's very important. That should be very clearly understood. Vedanta doesn't draw this red line, this is wrong, this is right. No. That's why if you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find all kinds of people come to Sri Ramakrishna's dictionary. There are agnostics, conservative believers, there are atheists, and there are all kinds of people. And they were all welcome. And Sri Ramakrishna never told them, you are wrong. From now onwards you should believe this. He never told them. But when they left, they felt they were taking home something from him. He gave them some message, which they took home, which was a source of inspiration and consolation to them. You know, Vedanta is like that. See, Ramakrishna is a real archetype of Vedanta. Vedanta never tells you that an anthropomorphic God or a creator God is a wrong concept. No, it is right. Just as when you are going to the primary school, what you study is the highest wisdom, no doubt. Do you understand there is a higher possibility when you reach Stanford, not before? That's all. So when you reach a higher university, you don't forget what you learned in primary school, but you learn more of what you study in primary school. So you don't put it into, no, this is wrong. Vedanta never said that. That's a very, very important point to remember.
Have the idea that this is God's universe and God didn't do a very good job. So you have that.
Could you repeat that once more?
When you have the feeling that in the dualism that this is God's universe, that he could have done a better job, which is what a lot of people think. So they have a powerful discontent with God's world.
Yeah.
But that's like a childish mind, which is really based in attachment. So how can that mind then go to Vedanta for an answer?
At the beginning of our spiritual life, we may have a strong faith in whatever we believe in our idea. Nothing wrong in it. So at the beginning, we must intellectually get acquainted with these ideas. So at the beginning of a spiritual life, even when we are following a dualistic tradition with all strong faith and commitment, nothing wrong in it. So when we read these books, we need not feel any contradiction. We feel that there is a higher possibility of giving a higher interpretation to the absolute reality, higher than the dualistic interpretation. But slowly, as we become aware of this, you don't say this is wrong, you say there is a more complete picture of what you actually believed in earlier. So from when a dualist evolves into non-dualism, he or she doesn't negate what he or she believed in earlier, rather you get a more complete picture of what you actually believed in earlier. So this is a very important point. There is absolutely no rejection, no line of demarcation that this is right, that is wrong in non-dualism. So just like, as you mentioned, you know, what you learn in the early stage of your education is not rejected. Only you get a more complete picture of what you learned in the primary school. When you get to the university, you get a more complete picture of what you learned in the primary school. There is nothing is negated, nothing is left behind, only you evolve. And the one interesting aspect of this, you don't feel a friction when you evolve like that. Mm-hmm. See, when you leave something behind and accept something new, there's a lot of friction. But in spiritual life, it is a very smooth, a natural evolution. So that's a very interesting point. It's not that you stop being a dualist and you become a non-dualist. No. You don't feel anything. You don't feel you are getting anything new. As you get a more complete picture, there's a natural, gradual evolution. In evolution, there is no friction. In change, there is friction. But in evolution, there is no friction. So it's not a jerky road. It's a natural. We outgrow the earlier limitations. That's what happens.
Swamiji said that from going from lower truth to higher truth.
Yeah. The lower truth is, of course, it's probably like what Swamiji meant was from a more from an incomplete picture of the same reality towards a more complete picture of the same reality. That's what it actually implies. So we'll... Okay, please, Swami.
Well, Swami, I was thinking of responding to Indra's question that many of the great mystics and sages say that God created everything perfect in His own image and likeness without any delusion or illusion, but that the delusion comes from the human mind, which imposes these problems on this perfect world that God has created. So we can't blame God for the pain and the suffering. That comes from us, from our mistakes.
But that was not my question.
Oh, it wasn't. Okay, I'm sorry.
I was trying to say that if we are pure,
yes,
delusion should not come to our mind. Why did it come?
Because of us.
But that is the
not from God.
No, no, I'm not saying from God. I'm not blaming God.
We're already pure.
I'm saying I'm saying how in this mind these delusions occur. Yeah. Anyway, that's the
God created us.
Yeah.
You know, in our traditions, there is a concept of we are coming from perfection, we are moving towards perfection, this intermediary stage is life and so on. The idea that you raise, actually this is raised by Ramanuja and other non-dualistic philosophers like Ramanuja and other. If liberation is our true nature, then why should this ignorance or delusion come to the mind? The question and the answer is, if liberation is not our true nature, we can never get it. If delusion is our true nature, we will not lose it. And if liberation is not our true nature, we will never really get it. So the very fact that when you evolve in spiritual life, you feel you have come out of the delusion and you feel a kind of inner perfection, it's called Jivan Mukti, which is found in all great spiritual teachers, that shows that's our true nature. So what we left behind was something that came. The question is, why should it come? Why should a misunderstanding come? A misunderstanding can come, but the misunderstanding doesn't necessarily violate the reality of true real wisdom.
That's understood.
So, see, the sun is there, but if there are some clouds, you may not see the sun for the time being. You may ask the question, why should there be clouds? But the point is, clouds are part of nature. If clouds could permanently block the view of sun, then you can say, sun is one reality, ontological reality, clouds are another reality. But no, clouds vanish.
So and the Maya is
Maya is the real answer to the question. Maya is avidya. So Maya is nothing but the indescribable, the undefinable thing that we mistake to be real till we realize that it is not real. So the definition of Maya, sannapi, asannapi, vyatmigano, binnapi, abhinnapi, vyatmigano, sandapi, asandapi, vyatmigano, mahadbhuda, anirvajaniruva. So just try it. But it means Maya, or the answer to this question is something we cannot really explain. It is the great wonder. It is something that really doesn't exist. But we realize that it doesn't exist only when we come out of it. It is indescribable. In fact, that's the highest definition. Look at the creation. This universe. 13 billion years. But let's think of an entity that exists for, say, hundreds of trillions of years. For that person who lives for hundreds of trillions of years, this universe of 13 billion is just a few minutes coming and going. Just imagine, I can give another example. Suppose you are holding a big plate in your hand and you're traveling in a plane that travels 500 miles an hour. You're holding a big plate. And there's an ant in that plate. Okay. It stays there. If you ask the ant, are you moving? It says, I'm not moving. But you're actually, the ant is actually moving at 500 miles an hour. That you are moving. But you ask the ant, which is, stays quiet in the plate. It, I'm keeping quiet. I'm not moving anywhere. So everything is relative. Everything is relative. Okay, now we will continue. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ram Krishna Paramahamsa.